This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 5th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 128. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. Analyzing coronavirus pandemic messaging, comparing Dr. Bonnie Henry, BC Health Minister Adrian Dix, and Federal Health Minister Patty Hajdu. The big deal feature, research co-pollster Mario Canseco shares some of his findings about how coronavirus and the economic shutdown have changed Canadians. Plus, I'll award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those making a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or has the fight in British Columbia against the coronavirus taken a military tone? Healthcare workers are celebrated like they're soldiers. Dr. Bonnie Henry is playing the role of a general. And, like a war, the truth becomes the first casualty. Henry is one half of the Monday to Saturday news conference duo with NDP Health Minister Adrian Dix. In a 2018 Proust questionnaire published by the BC Medical Journal, Henry said that her greatest regret was not being a better communicator to her patients, colleagues, family, and friends. The soft-spoken Henry has brushed up her communication skills since then, with the help of government communications. As the pandemic has unfolded, Henry's message has also changed. Mixed messages, misleading messages, or just evolving in an environment that changes by the hour. You be the judge. Exhibit A, March 13th, Friday the 13th. 2 days after the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic, and just 1 day after banning public gatherings of 250 or more people in BC, Henry encouraged British Columbians to get out and enjoy the last weekend of winter.
You know, there are many things we can do. We're not talking about shutting down society here. We are. It's still very safe today in BC, all across BC, to go out, to go shopping, to go to restaurants. And in particular, we have a lot of things that we can do outdoors, which are very safe things to do. This virus does not transmit when people are outdoors. So go outside and play with your family. Go up to our ski hills. Go up to Whistler. Go out and experience what we have here in British Columbia right now.
On March 16th, a different mood.
It has been a challenging weekend and a weekend of change where we've been watching what has been happening both across the country and around the globe with COVID-19. And as I know everyone in this room is aware, the situation is escalating around us and here in British Columbia as well. And there are things that we need to do now to take action to protect our citizens, our communities, our families here.
March 17th, Henry declares a public health emergency in BC.
We have taken the extra step of declaring a public health emergency in the province of British Columbia. This is something that, as you know, we've had as a tool in our toolkit for some time, and I felt that today was the tool, this is the tool that we need now. We've taken a number of unprecedented measures in the last few days, and this declaration of an emergency enables me to be faster, more streamlined, and nimble in the things that we need to do right now.
On March 20th at a press conference, Henry advised against healthy people wearing masks.
Us all wearing masks is one, a colossal waste of masks. And we know that people who aren't ill and are wearing a mask often fiddle with their face. And that can be a risk for them self-inoculating and becoming ill. So that's part of our rationale. We need to keep the mask for where they're needed. And I do recognize, however, and we've talked about this before as well, I do recognize that it is an expectation and a symbol of respect in some societies that you wear a mask when you're out to protect others.
April 1st, Henry changed her tune. She says that masks are now okay for the public with some conditions.
The use of non-medical masks, so things like homemade or cloth masks, by people who don't have any symptoms, may reduce, in some cases, the touching of your face, although we do need to be careful with putting them on and taking them off and the importance of washing your hands or cleaning your hands when doing that. But we also know that they can have some benefit in keeping your droplets in. So they're not, we need to be a little bit careful. You know, they're not a medical mask, but they can keep your droplets in when you're out and about with others. What is not proven is that they provide you any protection. And I think that's the really critical part.
On March 23rd, Henry said that there were no shortages of personal protective equipment like masks and gloves and goggles in BC hospitals.
We are not aware currently of shortages in our system in BC right now, but we are, of course, monitoring that very carefully on a day-by-day basis. And we have shipments coming in. We've been working with our federal partners so that there is large purchases across the country that will be supporting us.
2 days later, on March 25th, Henry says that BC needs more masks.
Going through way more personal protective equipment than we expected. So we are on a tenuous level right now.
On March 31st, reporters grilled Henry on why more information is not released to the public.
Hi, good afternoon, Dr. Henry. We've had sources tell us of a case in the downtown East Side building. Would you ever announce this publicly if it were confirmed? You know, you've announced similar cases in seniors' homes and other vulnerable areas, and this would affect a vulnerable population.
So no, we would not identify an individual case unless it was related to an outbreak. So we do have protocols that we use all the time around outbreaks. And for example, today, the community outbreak that we announced, because it is in the public interest to understand what's happening there, and the investigation is ongoing. We also have a very detailed protocol for announcing outbreaks in facilities, and we have a very low threshold, as I mentioned, for particularly for long-term care.
Following up on that last question, you've been asked many times why you're not identifying communities in which COVID-19 patients are located. And I can recite from memory your answers, those being privacy reasons, you don't want to discourage people from coming forward, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you've also said all of your decisions are based on the best available evidence. So can you tell me on which evidence this non-disclosure policy is based? And if I may, Minister Dix, the governments of Alberta, Ontario, and Quebec all report cases at the community level. Will you reconsider this policy? Thank you.
Yeah. So this is not a non-disclosure policy. This is how we do business in terms of public health.
For the record, the Oxford Dictionary defines non-disclosure as the fact or practice of not making information known. And Oxford also defines policy as a course or principle of action adopted or proposed by an organization or individual. Meanwhile, British Columbians are getting a glimpse of what a Premier Adrian Dix would have looked like if the NDP had won the 2013 election. Dix, more than Premier John Horgan, has been the public face of the NDP government in recent weeks. On February 17th in Chinatown, this is what Dix had to say when he stood beside Federal Health Minister Patty Hajdu.
I have to say, I wanted to hear that to express my appreciation for the federal government, because we work together multiple times a week to ensure that we're getting the right information to the public. The level of cooperation, I think, it's fair to say, I wouldn't call it unusual, but it's at a very high level, and I think it reflects the seriousness with which we take this issue.
Hajdu complimented the People's Republic of China and said Canada was not going to close its borders.
Well, I understand that there's some voices that would say that we should shut down the border to China. But I would say that Canada is following expert advice from the World Health Organization and working closely with allied partners like France and the UK and Germany, who have decided to take a different approach than the approach that the Australians and Americans have taken, for a whole bunch of reasons. First being that it's much easier to support people from a region that's experienced such an outbreak if we know that where they're coming from. And the evidence says that when you shut down a border like that, it gets much harder to actually detect where people are coming from, because people are determined to get into a country or a return home, and they will find alternative routes to do so. Secondly, the long-term implications of shutting down borders is one, they're not very effective in controlling disease, as in fact, they're not effective at all. And secondly, they actually long-term can create a greater risk to global public health. And here's why. China has been very open. Now, some will say, were they open enough and how fast were they open? But what we know is that within a week or so, they were letting the World Health Organization and therefore all of the partner countries know that they had an outbreak on their hand. And more than that, they were sharing the sequence of the virus, which was really important to other countries like Canada to be able to have the evidence to do the investigation and the testing in Canada. Imagine now if countries were to suspect that if they had an outbreak, the border would get closed, there would be sanctions economically, and all of a sudden that transparency that the world relies on in order to defeat viruses like coronavirus and protect the health of their citizens. Imagine if, in fact, countries stopped sharing that information. We would, in a global health sense, be in a bit of a pickle, if you will.
On March 16th, Dix was clear in his messaging that Canada needed to close the borders. And eventually that happened.
I support all the measures the Prime Minister has taken. I'd like him to take one more, which is to also apply it to the United States, to visitors, to non-essential traffic. I mean, we think that strong action has to be taken at the border. And I think the situation in British Columbia is such, the situation in Washington State is such, that should be made clear so that it's not there's not an issue of nuance. It's true that if people want to visit from Washington State, they need to self-isolate for 14 days. But I think in the case of visitors, as opposed to non-essential people, people who aren't involved in the transportation of goods and services that are necessary for our society, I think clearly we're saying to people, don't come.
On April 2nd, Patty Hajdu reiterated her trust of China and suggested that a reporter was offside for even asking.
There's no indication that the data that came out of China in terms of their infection rate and their death rate was falsified in any way. In fact, if you look at the death rate overall in China, it's much higher than the one we're seeing now. And so we rely on the World Health Organization to do this important work because, of course, we're all in this together. And
respect, Minister, if we're trusting the World Health Organization, China has shown that they figured this out. How can we trust the World Health Organization?
So I would say that your question is feeding into the conspiracy theories that many people have been perpetuating on the internet. And it's important to remember that there is no way to beat a global pandemic if we're actually not willing to work together as a globe. We will have to come up with a global solution to this virus. No country is an island.
For the record, Taiwan is a self-governing country and it is an island, a country that has managed the coronavirus outbreak better than most in the world. Wuhan Coronavirus Pandemic 2020. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. Frank Tang in the South China Morning Post. China's unemployment crisis mounts, but nobody knows true number of jobless. Debate over China's unemployment reality amid coronavirus heats up with holes picked in official government stats. As many as 205 million Chinese workers cannot find jobs or are unable to return to their previous posts, according to one analyst. If true, that figure would represent more than a quarter of China's 775 million workforce and would be vastly higher than the 6.2% figure posited by the government's survey. An estimated 180 million service sector jobs disappeared due to the outbreak. Economists and analysts have started to rely on private surveys, online job listings, anecdotal reports, and even indicators such as subway rides in major cities to get a clearer view of the impacts of the coronavirus outbreak on the unemployment situation in China. Michael Nielsen in the New Zealand Herald, Auckland dad to run lockdown marathon around his house. Logan James plans to run the full 42.2 kilometer marathon distance in laps around his family house in Huaipai. He estimates it will take about 600 circuits, and he's aiming to do it in about 4 hours. He first laid down a 10-kilometer challenge around his house and did that last week, all 154 laps. James ran the Auckland Marathon in October and previously two ultra-marathons, one 60 kilometers and one 100 kilometers. Zaldi Komanda in the Manila Bulletin, rat-catching challenge launched in Bagua Public Market. Mayor Benjamin Megalong launched a rat-catching challenge to address sanitation issues and to prevent the spread of COVID-19. As a reward, Megalong has dangled 20,000 pesos, more than $550, for the vendor who would be able to catch the most number of rats this April. 10,000 pesos will go to the second placer. At the launch on April 1st alone, some 133 rats were caught, while on the second day, 186 rats captured. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. Douglas Perry in the Oregonian. Some Oregon stores take advantage of coronavirus crisis to jack up prices on masks, toilet paper. Attorney General on the case. So far, more than 125 official price gouging complaints have come into DOJ through its hotline in online form. They cite a large variety of items, including meat, bread, eggs, rice, coffee creamer, ramen, marijuana, bleach, paper towels, detergent, thermometers, and even TVs, hotel rooms, video conferencing services, and guns. Almost all the recipients of the cease and desist letters so far are small business owners and convenience store franchisees. Ultimately, the penalty could be up to $25,000 per violation, along with the reimbursement of customers. Robert Mittendorf in the Bellingham Herald. Whatcom report on coronavirus response shows hospital status, more cases projected. Confirmed cases of the new coronavirus will climb to well over 200 infections in Whatcom County by this weekend, according to a daily situation report from Whatcom Unified Command, the agency that is handling local response to the pandemic. Whatcom County Health Department reported on its website 144 confirmed cases and 8 deaths on Wednesday, April 1st. Julian Kolsut on Czech News. The Cedar Hills Golf Course in Saanich is pleading with the public to stay off their closed course. The facility is owned by the municipality and was closed due to COVID-19 concerns. Part of the problem may be that the walking trail that surrounds the course is still open. A quick walk on the green can have some pretty long-term ramifications. A piece of grass ripped out around the size of a hand, it can take up to 6 months to grow back. Each job costs hundreds of dollars. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast, and we welcome back Mario Canseco from Research Co. Mario Canseco, a pollster with his finger on the pulse. Mario Canseco is here to talk about coronavirus, COVID-19, how it's affecting Canadians, what he's found out in his research. Start off telling us what it's like in your part of Vancouver.
It's definitely quieter than it was just a few weeks ago. Not a lot of people out on the streets, not a lot of people on the stores. It's been definitely a different experience, particularly if you're confined to your home and you're looking at a lot of residents who might be going out, who might be parking cars on the street and not necessarily on their garages. And we haven't really seen a lot of movement on that front. We are fairly close to a couple of grocery stores, and you definitely see some traffic, but certainly not at the level that we had in the middle of February, for instance.
Now, you also have family in both Mexico and Italy. Tell me what they've been telling you.
Well, Italy, I think that was one of the situations that made it a little bit easier to understand where this was going to be going. You know, I do have family in Italy. They're in Lombardy, at the area where this is definitely one of the most difficult issues that they faced. And we sort of saw this coming by the middle of February, the fact that they were trying to implement certain measures and that we somehow knew they were going to be getting closer to us here in North America. There's good spirits. There's a sense that the government has handled this to the best of their ability, even though there is a lot of criticism of certain decisions that were taken early on. Mexico is a completely different situation, unfortunately. President López Obrador, up to 4 or 5 days ago, was still saying that this was not a crisis, that everything could be solved, that he himself could be shielded from this coronavirus because he had some religious artifacts with him all the time. In a country that can be staunchly Catholic, this is definitely not the kind of message that you want to send. And over the past 48 hours, they've been talking a little bit more about social distancing, but certainly not at the level that we've seen in other Latin American countries. So there's definitely a lot of concern about what is going to be happening there, not necessarily because Mexicans aren't paying attention to the news and are actually self-isolating themselves, but because the president definitely missed the chance to explain to Mexico just how detrimental this could be.
And back to Canada, Mario, where Canadians' lives have changed considerably since early to mid-March. We've got several religious occasions coming up pretty soon, and Canadians who are religious say that they're praying more regularly.
Well, one thing that really struck me about the numbers when it came to religious Canadians was that there's one out of four, 25%, who are saying that they are essentially praying more often than they did before. But it climbs all the way to 30% with those in the highest income bracket. So it's a situation where religious Canadians are more likely to be concerned and to be pleading from help from other sources, if you will, if they are in the highest income bracket. We don't see the same type of situation with middle income or with the lower income. But it hasn't really changed a lot as far as other things that they could be doing. There's also more people who are meditating, who are taking some time to reflect on where this is going and how they have to do what they have to do in their daily lives. And it's higher in British Columbia. That is no surprise. But it's not as massive as one would have assumed. You know, we don't have a situation where there's people suddenly praying more, meditating more because of what is happening. If anything, I think what we see is more distractions. You know, people who are streaming content more often, playing games with their game consoles, for instance, or even board games, puzzles, anything that they can do to try to keep their minds away from the situation.
A lot of people are keeping their eyes and their ears very close to the situation. You found that 3 in 5 are actually watching more news. This is good news for those of us in the media industry, although, unfortunately, because the economy has basically stopped to a trickle, it has hurt the bottom line of several newspaper companies. There is more hunger, more demand than ever for news, at the same time as the economics of it are getting more difficult for the big companies.
Yeah, it's a level of support for the industry that is quite interesting. I've never seen this many Canadians following the news unless there's an election happening. Whenever you ask Canadians, did you watch the news? Are you essentially paying attention to what is happening in the world or in the country? It's usually around the 40-45% level. To have it at 61 certainly suggests that there's more attention to this. But when you look at it from the standpoint of the economics of the issue, during elections, you have a lot of expenditures from governments or from those parties who want to remain in government, from the opposition. That is what is feeding into the media machine that allows you to have all of this. We don't have that anymore because there's no campaign happening. And there's no sense for specific businesses to advertise when they're still closed. So it's definitely a very delicate balance at this stage. The appetite for information and for good, verified, sourced information is higher than it's been before for something that is not related to an election. But there's also dwindling resources because the ads are not there.
And Canadians right now miss going out to restaurants, concerts, movies, and sports in that order. They can't afford to right now. And unfortunately, that's where a lot of the job losses have been in the hospitality and tourism industries.
No, it's a difficult situation. I think what we see there is a scenario where the younger generation is definitely more dissatisfied with the fact that they can do all the things they wanted to. Going to the movies, going to see a place, concerts. You know, we've seen some cancellations of entire tours already. So that's going to play a role in this. And what was really striking to me is the only area where we have a gender gap that is quite noticeable is on sports. You know, there's 41% of men in Canada who say, I miss watching soccer, I miss watching hockey or basketball, I miss the fact that the baseball season hasn't started, but it only drops to 24% among women. So, you know, you go back to other situations that we faced, the financial crisis of 2008, for instance, or right after 9/11, sports played a very big role in getting everybody to sort of wake up from the rot that we had because of the scenarios that we were facing. But we don't even have that now. So it's more complicated, especially for those who have made sports part of their daily lives.
You found, for instance, that 72% of respondents want fines for those who ignore quarantine rules, people that aren't staying home if they've got symptoms. And 4 in 5 want fines for people who are hoarding and profiteering off the backs of others.
Yeah, that was one of the most shocking findings of that particular survey. I thought we would see a little bit of animosity towards those who were trying to make a quick buck out of this, either by buying more than what they needed or by offering bogus cures against coronavirus. And the level of support from Canadians, not only for fining, but for jail time, is in the majority territory. So there's definitely a sense from Canadians of dissatisfaction and dismay with the behavior of some of their fellow citizens who saw this as an opportunity to do something and to benefit. Now that we've had so many weeks of our lives being altered by COVID-19, there's even more animosity towards those who behave that way in the early stages. And I think it's going to be difficult for many of those who have been prominently featured in the media because of their actions to come back from this. I don't think this is an issue that is going to be easily forgotten by most Canadians.
Now, we have a situation also where governments at all levels have become more powerful by invoking various laws. Federally, there is the Quarantine Act. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has not yet invoked the Emergencies Act, but he has been talking about that. Here in British Columbia, there is a state of emergency. There's also a public health emergency. There was an emergency at the City of Vancouver level. Our governments have more power right now. Our governments also are taking more time of the day to communicate in various ways, whether it's Health Minister Adrian Dix and Dr. Bonnie Henry in their daily update on coronavirus cases here in BC, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his pandemic prose by the porch in Ottawa, telling us what is happening from the national scale, Doug Ford in Ontario, and other health officers and other politicians across the country. This has been a moment where governments have been speaking directly to the people and trying to assure the people that they're doing the right thing. At the same time, of course, there's still questions about access to information and how Canadians' rights to access information through FOI laws, for instance, have been largely put on hold. You found that two-thirds of respondents to your poll approve of the federal government performance, and about 70% of them say that the provincial government where they live is doing a good job managing the crisis.
Yes. What is fascinating to me about this is that there's a higher level of satisfaction with what the Trudeau government is doing, especially when you compare it to the number of votes they got in the last election. And we are talking about a government that was elected with the support of around a third of Canadians who actually cast a ballot in the election. And now you have 66% saying that they're doing a good job. This is completely different from what we see in the United States, for instance, where the numbers for Donald Trump are nowhere near that level of support from those who didn't vote for him. And similar situation happening in other European countries. So there's something there about the level of connectivity that Canadians have right now with the federal government. Now, that being said, this is almost like an election. You know, every 3 days there's something new. There's a new announcement. There's a new situation that might be beneficial to you or that might be worrying you. So this is a number that we definitely want to continue tracking as this crisis continues. Is this going to be a situation where the government is actually connecting better than it was 2 weeks ago? Is it going to drop? And what is going to happen with specific governments around the country? You know, we saw a level of satisfaction with what the government of Quebec is doing that was off the charts, 84%. But that was before they had more cases. That was before they had different guidelines in place. So as this crisis continues, what is going to happen with some of those provincial governments? We've seen a lot of praise for Doug Ford, I should say, on social media. Is that going to manifest itself in more support for an Ontario government that 3 or 4 months ago had ratings that were certainly lower? So some governments are going to benefit from this crisis in the way they connect, and others are going to drop out.
This is, of course, a pandemic that started in China, in Wuhan, China. Your poll found that only about a third of Canadians want to launch legal action against China. That's interesting. That's a low number, but maybe is it because people are thinking other things right now of their own family and of their own jobs and of their own health before they're thinking of down the road?
I think it's a combination of things. One of them is definitely the fact that you're obviously concerned with other things, and trying to establish some sort of legal action at this stage is probably going to be too cumbersome, especially if it's something that that only entails a single government. But I think also the fact that this is growing more, I think what we've seen over the past couple of weeks is the number of cases not necessarily growing exponentially, but definitely getting closer to our communities. We're starting to know people who have been affected by this directly, and that is definitely going to play a role in the way we feel about this later. You know, there's always been this discussion. There's been questions to specific levels of government. And the answer is always, once all of this is over, we're going to regroup and we're going to try to figure out who was responsible for this and how it is happening. Unfortunately, we have a very wide campaign of misinformation happening on social media related to the origin of the virus, in certain discussions that are coming out of China. But even before this began, we already had a situation in Canada where the views on China and its government were definitely lower than they were before. And the level of animosity towards Huawei participating in the 5G network was always higher in British Columbia than anywhere else. So it's not something that is going to go away after coronavirus. If anything, those numbers might actually be lower.
Well, thank you very much for joining us on the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Mario Canseco, president of Research Co. You can find out all the information about Mario's polls at researchco.ca. The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the common sense folks at the Ministry of Health who canceled parking fees at hospitals around BC, and the common sense folks at Vancouver City Hall who temporarily withdrew parking enforcement. Yes, amid the coronavirus crisis and related instant recession, there is common sense. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 5th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on April 5th in 1976, the Tiananmen Incident, a protest in Tiananmen Square in Beijing against the Chinese government after Premier Zhou Enlai's death, and in 1994, Kurt Cobain died. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. PATREON.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.